I'm really glad to be joined again by Landon Lofton and Max Leaf to talk about Owen Barfield once more. And the prompt for our gathering today is a new collection of essays by Barfield that's been published by the Barfield Press, edited by Rory O'Connor, and it's called The Riddle of the Sphinx. And it's a very lightly produced book, lots of fascinating talks, particularly that Barfield gave. Often the best way into his thought, I think. And certainly this essay collection gives a really nice range of Barfield's ideas. We're gathered because separately we've already written books about Barfield, so just while we're doing the book plug, this one's mine, A Secret History of Christianity, which looks particularly at Christianity through Barfield's eyes, as I interpret it anyway. And then, Landon, your book with Max is
What Barfield thought.
great, which is a
Basically, to Barfield's thought, more like from the philosophical perspective, it challenges, I think, a lot of conventional views, and so we were just trying to give people an easier entry point to understand Barfield's key theories and theses.
So look up those as well as The Riddle of the Sphinx. And what I thought we might do is pick maybe half a dozen elements that really came out well from this new collection. Why Barfield matters to us, why Barfield challenges us, Barfield's ideas and broader conception of matters in the world today. And Landon, you picked up one, I think, which it's a very important notion for me as well, coming from Barfield, the philologist, and how he looks at the changing meaning of language. So, do you want to kick our discussion off with that?
Sure, yeah. Well, first of all, reading this collection, I was familiar with a lot of the essays before they've been available online, I think most of them. But I get so much more from a book than a screen, and that was really driven home to me with this. But as I was reading through these essays, a lot of them contain something that Barfield does so well. He'll talk about the same subject that he's talked about 100 times before, but just from a slightly different angle, and it's illuminating every time. And so there were a couple essays that were particularly interesting to me. One was called Greek Thought in English Words. And there's a passage I might read at length just to give everybody a taste for what it's about. And it's really Barfield at his best, in my opinion, where he looks at the history of words and sees so much more than, etymologists that you might speak to in an academic context are prone to seeing. He sees the whole history of the human mind, a sort of a spiritual history of humanity. And so here's a passage from that essay. Some knowledge of the semantic history of such words, he goes through words that have evidence debts in to Greek thought, from such words is practically essential to any historical understanding of the Western outlook. And then he goes on. I'm sorry. And he says, Plato and Socrates, like most of the philosophers before them, dealt with feelings and thoughts, and even words to some extent as if they were living beings. They related them to one another in accordance with what they conceived to be their own intrinsic natures, proving their points by analogy and by etymology. And it is only later, when men began to have a different feeling of the nature of thought and of their own relation to the thoughts which passed through their minds, that this kind of reasoning came to be criticized as mere verbal quibbling. So I remember being a freshman in college, a philosophy major, and reading Plato for the first time and thinking, how silly this argument by analogy. This is so obviously fallacious. We're so much smarter than these people. And of course, that was a really silly thing for me to think. But I was never able to put my finger on exactly why I was wrong in so hastily dismissing Plato and all these arguments from analogy. But that's because I didn't understand anything about the evolution of consciousness, which Barfield's explaining here.
I mean, maybe, Landon, you're going to say more about this, but this difference between modern philosophy that tries to use language to kind of prove things, rationally, through coherence and various kind of modern objective criteria. Whereas Barfield's saying that for someone like Plato, the aim was to enter more fully into the experience of something through words. And so then analogy opens up participation. And so unless you recognize that complete a different approach, you might well read Plato and think, this is a bit of a waste of time.
Yes, exactly. So there's, as he goes on, I'll continue reading. I think he gets to that. So, thus, there's really no way of translating words like logos as they are used by Plato. Reason is quite inadequate to convey to a 20th century imagination the cosmic process which Plato must have felt to be taking place, out as much out in the world and among the stars as within his own mind. So this idea that words are like tools that the subjective individual mind can use, like pull them out of a toolbox and use them to put together an argument or something like that, is very much a modern thing. And so he goes on then to talk about Aristotle and how the process by which we came to think of reason exclusively as something that goes on in the individual mind really began in earnest with Aristotle. So he says the word syllogism itself is first found with that meaning in Aristotle's works. And so logic, that exclusively subjective process, is revealed to us as something which the mind only discovered when it began to turn outward to matter. In analyzing its environment, it seems, and submitting itself humbly to the results of observation, the mind first began to feel its own shape and parts, much as the fingers discover the relation to one another when they're trying to fit themselves into a glove. So,
Mark and Landon, to build on, basically, Landon, what you read and the comment that you had, Mark, about actually changing conception of knowledge and truth and the purpose of philosophy. I think it's quite illuminating, actually, to contemplate the two Latin words for knowledge, broadly construed. I have in mind scientia, which is, of course, the like origin of our English word science, and then sapientia, which is often translated either as knowledge or wisdom. And if you kind of dial back towards the etymologies of both those words in the like spirit of philology and in the kind of spirit of Owen Barfield, you will immediately find like a very different picture. Scientia has to do with same root as words like schism and scissors. Has to do with analysis. And in fact, Barfield makes the point. I don't know if it's in Greek thought and English words or is it called what is it? The essay immediately prior to that, Form and Poetry. Maybe?
Form and Poetry.
Yeah, it's in one of those essays. He actually observes that Plato coined the word analogy or analogous, whereas Aristotle coined the word analysis, which is a very different picture. And I think that maps really neatly onto the difference between sapientia and scientia. Scientia has to do with, well, analysis is probably the best way to put it. Sapientia is very different. It, if you mean like literally contained in that word, is the verb to taste. So that's rather than establishing truth or knowledge on the basis of syllogism, for instance, this is a question of experiential truth, question of truth as aletheia, like revelation or disclosure, and I think you do see that Aristotle kind of carries thought into a new age by introducing this much more analytical, rational approach, whereas Plato still he's coming from. You could also distinguish between nous and dianoia. These are like just very various different ways of getting at this distinction, which is really a distinction in different modes of thought and different modes of perception.
Yeah, and the two can work together. It's not like one is better than the other, because analysis can open up more sophisticated and nuanced kinds of analogy, and so the two can work together. And I think that's worth stressing. But what matters is when analysis, say in the modern world, becomes uncoupled from analogy and so is somehow seen as superior or the only valid route to knowledge. And then what you have happen is a kind of a withdrawal of participation, as Barfield puts it, where analysis just tries to run more and more on its own steam without the contact with reality that analogy brings. and either gets lost in its own footnotes or sort of grinds to a halt even, and no new things are discovered because the source has been forgotten. And I guess that's, we'll probably come on to this later in the discussion, but I think that's one of the things which he feels a figure like Rudolf Steiner enables us to do, is to regain a kind of accuracy when it comes to analogy, and so lead to the increase of knowledge in that way.
But that's a great way to illustrate. Well, what you said about the way that the analytical approach can actually serve to refine and perfect and make more, you know, render more accurate our analogies. But I think, you know, the point is to always keep that in mind, that analysis should be in the service of the higher mode of thought, rather than the other way around, and think of the higher mode of thought as something like a, like Lennon said, a mistake or just like a mere conceit. I think maybe this seems to me to map very neatly actually onto the distinction that we've set up. I think, correct me if I'm wrong about this, but in his farewell address at Oxford, Tolkien actually lamented the throughout the universities the replacement of philology departments with linguistics departments. Linguistics, this is like pure analytical quantitative, attempting to take language and turn it into something that can be quantified, measured, interpreted in terms of statistical analysis. This could, you know, this, that's such a quintessential example of the purely analytical mode divorced from, you know, the higher mode. Whereas philology, you almost have, what's clear, like philology, it's contained right in the etymology. It's some kind of, you know, love or appreciation of the language itself. You could be a linguist without actually knowing. You could be a linguist for a language you don't speak. You just plug this into some algorithms and chug away.
Yeah. Max, it's interesting you bring up Tolkien. I was just thinking of that line in The Lord of the Rings where Gandalf speaks to Saruman, and I can't quote it exactly, but it's something to the effect. He says, "He who breaks a thing apart to find out what it is has left the path of wisdom." And very so nice. There's a kind of death by analysis that, again, analysis is a good thing and a helpful thing. It's necessary if we're going to think rigorously about the world. But if we assume that things are only the sum of their parts, which is, I think, what a lot of people who are interested in analysis assume, then we're going to, you know, pull the world to pieces and find nothing that made us originally interested in the world to begin with. So
by a thousand cuts.
Yeah, yeah.
Landon,
but
you
the
have
idea, like an organism is more than the sum of its parts. And so you can, you know, dissect a human body and, you know.
But it's precisely the analogy, like the kind of thinking we've indexed to analogy that is capable of actually perceiving and apprehending holes in themselves. Lennon, you or Mark, do you happen to have on hand the quote by Barfield? It's one of the amazing quotes about the poet is, so the world has been torn asunder like Dionysus, but the poet is Zeus.
And he's swallowed the heart of the world and reproduced it as a living whole.
Beautiful, beautiful, yeah.
I think that there is a sense in which this insight is informing the sciences, actually. I've recently been reading and even writing about moves in biology, which are sometimes called systems biology. And the idea is that the reductive approach that reached its kind of nadir with Richard Dawkins and the selfish gene ran out of explanatory steam, as if, you know, the gene is the code that drives everything above it. And now the biologists have realized, once again, the power of parts and wholes and integrated levels and the kind of way that this plays up and down the, not just the, you know, the cell or the organism, but the organism in its wider ecological environment as well. And what interests me is that the notion of analogy starts to get used, that something that might be seen in one level is analogous to that which might be seen at another level. So, for example, you might have attraction and then cooperation at some level that becomes altruism and empathy at another, and then manifests as love in certainly human beings such as us. And that way in which, therefore, a kind of top-down sense of things informing the bottom, as well as the bottom up informing the top. You feel it in discussions of emergence, for example. It's not fully reformed, and then things like emergence run into trouble because there's a discussion about whether there can only be weak emergence, that which is nascent in the earlier forms developing to give birth to that which is present in the later forms, or whether there's strong emergence, radically new things can emerge. So you get these kind of discussions going on, but I feel like this sense is making its way back, at least in some respects, into, say, the biological sciences. I don't know whether you sense that at all.
I think it's just right. You run up into a limit if you insist on attempting to describe wholes merely in terms of their parts, and eventually you're not going to be able to do it. So either you just throw up your hands and say, there's no explanation here, or you call it chance, you know, which is virtually the same thing, or you're forced to actually acknowledge something. And I agree with you, a term like emergence is suggestive. To me, it still indicates like an attempt to, well, a recognition of the presence of the whole, but kind of stopping short and balking at the real critical point of actually recognizing the reality of wholes in themselves, and the reality of, this is returning almost to much more pre-modern Aristotelian view about formal causes and entelecheia and energeia. But I think a great example of what you are indicating about the wholes and parts is something that, and the way that love actually, if you know how to look, you will find it at all scales. And St. Paul, from that very thought, he uses in the letter to the Corinthians. I mean, he says, think about how the body and the members of the body collaborate into one, and all the members are various and yet one at the same time. And he says, this is the way to think about the higher body of the mystical body of Christ, that in a certain way, what seems like diversity, if you know how to look and you look in the right way, then you can begin to see the overarching unity that actually pours into the diverse members, gives them identity, gives them meaning, gives them identity.
Yes, it's something which we intuitively know, you couldn't live without. You know, it would be a very desperate life to live without that sense. And yet how that filters into what we call scientific knowledge. And maybe these notions like emergence, as maybe you're suggesting there, Max, are kind of a last gasp at reductive explanations before tipping into something like the old use of analogy.
Well, it's quite a stumbling block, actually, because science, like as we established, especially if you go back to the origin of science and Francis Bacon's idea, and it's implicit in the very etymology of that word, the very mode of thought on which science is established and develops itself is precisely analysis. And the one thing that analysis can't do is exactly what it's designed to do the opposite of, which is synthesize is not a great word, but analysis, it's like it's downward looking, so to speak. It's looking into the parts, down into the parts. And you'll never be able to see, this is like an extended conceit now, but you'll never be able to see what's behind you as long as you don't turn around and look towards, not towards the parts, but rather towards the whole. And so it's kind of like a plight that science has fallen into, that it's just very difficult. You need a substantial reimagination of what science entails. And Barfield, over and over again, I think, recognizes this, and then also points us to people who have tried to carry this task forward. Goethe and Steiner, of course, are two names that come to mind. Incidentally, today is the 163rd anniversary of the birth of Rudolf Steiner in 1861 on this day. So maybe it's kind of a felicitous occasion. Later in the discussion, we might have a chance to talk about Steiner and Owen Barfield's relationship to Steiner and how he, the significance he saw in Steiner's work.
No, definitely. That's coming up, because there's quite a lot of Steiner in this new book, or at least Barfield's attempts to communicate something of Steiner to us. Landon, you raised this particular issue, and I love the notion that it's very hard for us to imagine what Plato meant when he talked about reasoning, because of this sense of joining with the cosmic mind in that process. But is there anything else you particularly wanted to say on this particular issue before we move on to a second?
Yeah, well, I wanted to add something to what Max said earlier. He said that we have these options when we take a reductive view of science, such as the one that most people are in the habit of taking, that we can see these things that don't fit in the reductive picture, and we can say there is no explanation or chalk it up to chance or things like this. But unfortunately, I think the biggest barrier to a renewal in science is that people are in the habit of saying there's nothing to be explained. You know, when it doesn't fit into the methods that are current, we just deny there's anything to be explained. So you see this in science and also in like philosophy with, you know, the mysteries of consciousness, rather than take up the difficult problems that those raise and realize that our paradigms aren't sufficient. People are more in the habit of saying, if our paradigm can't explain it, then there must not be anything that needs to be explained. That's just something I wanted to follow up on. But I'm happy to move on now.
Yeah, no, and I agree, but there are sort of people chipping away at the edges. Funny enough, I was just looking at something on panpsychism earlier, because in the UK there'd been a program on a mainstream radio station on panpsychism, a program called In Our Time on Radio 4. And in the sort of commentary sphere, the social media and so on, it caused a bit of a stir, with some people even saying that panpsychism shouldn't be discussed because it's not scientific. It's just as much hocus. And whilst there was someone on the program criticizing panpsychism from a scientific point of view, nonetheless, that very sort of squabble, I think, is a sign that something perhaps is beginning to break down, even in the sort of hallowed halls of science and their programs like In Our Time, which on the whole claim to communicate science to us. You know, these scraps will go on, but I think that they're a sign of, well, at the end of the day, issues like consciousness aren't going away because we all have it, unless you want to just deny that we have it, which of course some people do. Barfield can help us, I think, work out what's at stake in these arguments. And this notion of the difference between analysis and analogy is one way of thinking about that. So that's really great.
Yeah.
On that same point about the limits of science and the constraints of a scientific paradigm, and then the kind of demand that something that the paradigm first first confirm something before you're willing to consider it as real. Thomas Kuhn has a great way of saying this. It's like, if you want to understand the dominant paradigm, consider the kinds of phenomena that are axiomatically dismissed as unscientific. And this will give you a very, very good picture of the actual boundaries of your scientific paradigm. And I think, you know, on a number of occasions already in this discussion, we've touched up on these boundaries.
Okay, well, let me move to a second issue, which I'll bring in, because it's something which I always read new material by Barfield for, which is his thoughts on evolution. And I mean, in this instance, Darwinian evolution, because, of course, Barfield is known for a different kind of evolution, the evolution of consciousness, which was much more like what Landon was just talking about. But he often, well, at least on occasion, makes reference to Darwinian evolution. And in this new collection, he does a handful of times. In one essay, Two Kinds of Forgetting, he does quite a lot of it. And the things that he points out are assumptions that Darwinian evolution rests on. And he sort of challenges them, says they are assumptions, with the implication that if we drop those assumptions, the evolution of ourselves and the world, the cosmos indeed, might look very, very different. And then it sort of, you know, raises this question of what would that difference be like? And it's quite teasing often, the way that Barfield talks about it. But the assumptions which he addresses are, for example, the notion of uniformitarianism. So this is the idea that in all times and in all places, the laws of nature, so-called, are the same. So they're the same on Earth as they are on the other side of the cosmos at the beginnings of time. And in particular, the laws of evolution have been the same across evolutionary timescales on planet Earth. And Barfield challenges this for a couple of reasons. One is that it is an inference. Of course, we can't know that the laws of nature are the same everywhere. And so it's an assumption that science needs in order to really get going. But also, and maybe in a bit more provocatively, he argues that what are called quantities and qualities are also distinguished by modern science. So quantities are thought to be more objective features of reality. You know, so the dimensions of an object, you might think, are the same regardless of the mind that's looking at the dimensions of an object. Whereas, say, the colour of an object, its quality, might be different depending on the mind that's looking at it. But Barfield noticed that Kant, for example, in his critique of reason, argued that this differentiation between qualities and quantities is artificial, that even quantities depend upon the mind that's looking at the object, so-called, concerned. So, for example, you know, the notion of space, the notion of time, too, are features of the mentality of the person, the being, experiencing space and time, and that they therefore would change as mentality changes. And so for Barfield, and you guys can pick me up on this and amplify the point and explain it better as well. For Barfield, the idea that quantities, which depend upon space and time, being the same across all times and spaces, is itself a fallacy that really doesn't hold up. And when you take into account that those basic facets of reality might not only have been experienced differently in different times and places, but therefore have been different in different so-called times and places, it immediately gets rather difficult to talk about it. But nonetheless, these assumptions of uniformitarianism, they're partly inferences, and so can be questionable in that way. But also, he argues there's good reasons, even from within modern philosophy, such as the Critique of Reason by Kant, to assume that that's not so. And if they aren't so, then the assumptions of Darwinian evolution don't really hold up. And so he wants to argue for a different understanding of evolution. But you guys...
That's my thing. Yeah, well, I think one of the axioms of science is something like consciousness and all of the qualities that are contained in consciousness are subjective. So when we're so the way that evolution is conceived, arguably in a naive way, and this is an argument that Steiner actually makes in some of his early work, and Barfield right away picks up on it and elaborates it. The way that evolution is conceived in a naive way is as though the familiar everyday world that we describe around us right now, as though you just kind of walk that back through time, and the world before humans existed, for example, consists of more or less the same kind of phenomena and objects that we see around us today, just in a prior state. The problem with that theory, and let's be clear about this entire evolutionary view or the Darwinian view, this is not like observations that are made. This is not a question of facts. This is a question of attempts to explain and render coherent observations that can be made. Like, you can't just go back in time and observe the state of the Earth and the state of the cosmos a million years ago. That's not something that's available. So these are conjectures about how best to conceive of this time. And so Barfield just points out that by the very log by so once again, the two premises are that all of the qualities that we experience are a function of our particular configuration of our sense organs and our nervous system that has taken however millions and even, you know, more than that years to arrive at this point. Now, then you try to explain the world prior to that outcome of evolution, but you're drawing on the very terms that are dependent on that are the outcome of that very process that you're now attempting to explain in the beginning. So you're drawing on qualities that are by the logic of the theory only present at the end of this evolution. You're drawing on those same qualities and back projecting them into a time before they could have conceivably existed by the very logic of the theory, because again they needed the human nervous system and configuration of the brain to exist in the way that we experience them today. So there's just a kind of, there's an inherent paradox there, and you as it stands, there's no way to reconcile that paradox without a substantial reimagination of the theory. And then I'll just touch on the first point that you made as well, Mark. And this is like, because this comes down to in a lack of possibility for direct observation. What is the, you know, this is like sort of drawing on the logic of Occam's razor, like what is the simplest explanation? What is the default explanation? And the default explanation of the evolution of life and the cosmos itself is, as you said, uniformitarianism. But there's no reason, but again, that's not an observation. That's a theory or a proposition, hypothesis. In order to see that as the default, you have to be taking as your model or your paradigm something like a heap, for instance. And I'll explain what I mean by that. Compare a heap. Imagine whatever are the molecular and elemental constituents of a flower, for instance. You could conceivably analyze all them and unpack them and turn them into a heap of the various elements. It would have the same matter present, but it would obviously not be a flower if it were just a heap of elements. The heap is going to, if the heap changes, is going to change in this kind of uniform, piecemeal way. And so again, that's the analogy that is drawn then to the universe as a whole and the Earth as a whole, is that it changes in the way that non-living aggregations will change. It changes through aggregation or disintegration, for instance. But a living thing presents a very different paradigm of change than an inert object or a non-living thing. It's clear that the flower, the way it changes is actually just as differentiated as the physical form of the flower itself. And like the physical form of the flower itself is differentiated between the leaves, the stem, the flower, the bud, all these different articulations. Life, the essence of life is actually to bear like a similar, analogous differentiation and articulation, not only in space, but also in time. Like living organisms don't just progress in a linear way. They progress there's a certain logic to it, of biologic in a way. The question is, do we think the universe as a whole is more akin to a heap or more akin to a living thing, more akin to more akin to a non-living thing, more akin to an organism? If you think it's more akin to an organism, there's no uniformitarianism would not be your default assumption. Quite on the contrary, you would have a default assumption of, patterned change through time.
Yeah. Landon, you seem to disappear momentarily then, but I hope that you're back safe and sound now. Yeah. did you catch that? Do you want to chip in as well? Just on this basic...
Well, in fact, I didn't hear it all. Yeah. I didn't hear it all, but I did just want to reiterate that this idea of uniformitarianism, we might treat it as a scientific conclusion, but it's just an assumption brought to scientific inquiry. And it's really more, on a more basic level, an assumption that is only rendered plausible by the idea that, as Barfield says, the world is a somewhat of which we are passive observers, rather than something that comes to us in an act of participation. And of course, if the human mind has changed over time, then the world has changed in ways that we have to reckon with. And the extent and nature of those changes, that's certainly up for debate. But the simple assumption, this uniformitarian assumption, is, I think, unwarranted unless we're willing to just admit outright that we believe the world is a somewhat that we're passive observers of. But that's hard to sustain, I think.
Yeah, and a somewhat in the sense also of an inert object. And if you want to know how an inert object is going to change over time, you're not going to discover that the principle of that change inside of the inert object. You have to see it as more or less adventitious result of the forces that are working upon it from outside. If you are regarding not an inert object, but an alert object, an organic object, a living object, you have to take a very different approach. And you have to understand that the way it's going to change is not just an accident. The way it's going to change is an expression of an inherent principle of change that is imminent to that thing. The question is the Earth more like the first thing or more like the second thing?
And just to gloss that, that's because living things have purposes, have intentions, have a telos and so on. They're not just machines.
And this is not like purpose in the sense that we might immediately construe it as if I leave and I'm going to go to the store, then I, you know, order all my... But this is like purpose in the sense that if you imagine pictures in this, like snapshots of the life cycle of a plant, in an instant, you can arrange them in a specific temporal sequence. And that's the way of thinking about purpose that is kind of unconscious purpose, pre-dialectic purpose. This is purpose that's formal purpose. This is purpose that's inherent in the very biology and the logic of the life of a living thing. That is just not present in non-living things.
I think a good gloss. Landon, yeah.
I think it's interesting to think about the assumption that there's levels to reality, you know, something like the inert to the organic or vegetative to, you know, up on to the rational, and that these levels of organization have to be explained at different levels. And the sort of scientific outlook that Barfield is here describing aims to explain the world in terms of the lowest level, which is, you know, that of inert matter, material. Whereas you can only explain the lowest level in light of explanations at higher levels. And that's what a renewed science would aim to do.
Yeah, and you know this. You know this by the kind of transcendental deduction that Kant introduces. You can explain, you know, plausibly explain in the way that science does and materialist science does. You can explain the lower level, but you haven't done... Your explanation is transcendentally beholden to your capacity for explanation, which doesn't come from the lower level, which comes from some higher place. But again, to use this metaphor, your back is always turned. And so in order to have a complete science, or a science that is not reductionistic — reductionistic basically means leading these higher order elements into lower ones — you will have to, as Plato describes, like a full turning of the soul in the allegory of the cave. You have to turn and look also in the other direction, and grasp the way in which the higher is also looking into the lower.
So, just to develop this a little bit and see whether this makes sense to you, one of the ways that this discussion intrigues me, I find it very compelling, this idea that uniformitarianism is an assumption that may not hold. But the question is, you know, what if it doesn't hold? How do we understand things then? And there perhaps are many ways of doing this, but one of the ways is to look towards the intuitive science of Rudolf Steiner, which I find very hard to grapple with, really, to be honest. But there's another way, which is to be a bit more monotheistic and theological. Because in, say, Christian theology of a figure like Gregory of Nyssa, there's the idea that creation, as we call it, actually takes place in eternity, and that what we experience in time is a kind of moving image of that eternal creation. And so whilst our perspective is certainly limited, we are participating, our minds, to use that analogy that Landon referenced earlier, is fitting into that divine mind, a bit like the hand fits into the glove. And so it feels like that is a way of understanding the notion of science and evolution and our perceptions of things that sort of can be trusted, because whilst certainly our mentality is going to limit how we understand reality, it feels to me that's not quite the same as saying our mentality will change reality. Because ultimately, our reality doesn't depend upon our mentality, it depends upon the divine mentality, if I can just put it like that. Hence this notion that creation takes place in the eternal mind and we have a temporal experience of that unfolding.
That's already participation, though, I think, in the higher mind. This, arguably, you could like think of this as what was, to some extent, at issue with the filioque, the question of whether creation proceeds from the, or the spirit proceeds from the Father alone or from the Father and the Son. And, you know, I don't even think it should be controversial that the principle of, like, time is part of creation. So creation could have happened in time in the way that we ordinarily conceive it. But I also think we, like, if that's true, and just, like, contemplation on the nature of eternity shows that eternity can't be some other time than now. It's rather every, like, time is a sort of articulation in the substance of eternity. So if you want to know, like, when is hanging around, when is eternity going to start, it's the wrong way to think about it. It's already always eternity. And time is again, like, a, you use the word image, you think of it as an image of eternity, or also, like, a configuration or articulation of eternity that way. And, you know, there's something about the rational element in us that allows us to contemplate these things that already depends on some ability for us to participate in this mind that's above time and beyond time.
I think that makes sense. Do you want to add at this point? Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, I think it's always interesting to think about the kinds of things that we talk about that go on in our minds. You know, we deal with these things that seem to me to be timeless and spaceless and therefore don't really fit well within a picture of the world that is completely bounded by space and time. So qualities and concepts and things, you know, these are, it's really a miracle from the standpoint of what we could just call the modern scientific outlook, that we can have these concepts, that we can contemplate concepts, which, if they're anything more than movement in the gray matter of our brain, are, seem to me, just self-evidently, we're participating in something, you know, eternal. We're beholding something that's not, it doesn't fit within the space-time continuum. But I think, you know, we explain those things away, but they're really, I mean, quite remarkable. It's an immediate experience of something beyond the confines of the bounds of space and time.
Yeah, I feel this matters for another reason as well. Last year, I was in Tamil Nadu in India and visited Auroville and Pondicherry, which are places where Sri Aurobindo lived and worked. And Sri Aurobindo is sometimes credited with bringing evolutionary ideas into Vedantic philosophy. But it seems to me that it can go very wrong when this notion that our intentions, our attitudes, our attention itself affects reality. Because then you get into this notion that somehow, maybe by meditative practices, we can actually change the world. Not just change our relationship to the world, but change the world itself. And certainly followers of Sri Aurobindo, under a figure called the Mother, they got into this notion and felt like the calling of humanity was to participate in the evolution of the world itself in a kind of more and more active and more deliberate way. And I don't know, I mean, it goes wrong because it feels to me, well, I mean, I think, you know, it's evidence that people get caught in, I don't know, assumptions they might heal themselves, or you know, they can perfect their very molecules, as it were, and become immortal or spiritualized in some way. That seems to me to be fairly self-evidently mistaken. But it maybe more broadly, it raises this question of what our purpose is as self-conscious beings, not just conscious beings, but self-conscious beings. And again, for me, I find myself returning more to mainstream Christian thinkers here, where our purpose is not to, as it were, get involved in the design of things, but maybe is to get involved more in the praise or the love, the participative qualities of things, and that that is our way of cooperating with the divine unfolding. Remembering, you might say, the difference between knowing the divine within us and actually being God, which, you know, clearly we're not. Again, Gregory of Nyssa, I find very helpful here. He says that we were made uncreated. We were made created to become uncreated. But remembering that difference is really important. I've slightly rambled around things here, but do you recognize any of that?
I see that the conflict or the scandal about like human beings playing God, basically, I think is what you're getting at. But it seems to me, and so I understand the wish to reject that kind of view. I think it's also a mistake, though, to go too far in the other direction and see us as kind of passive bystanders. I think there are powerful images in Scripture that actually suggest the right way to thread the needle, so to speak. I'm picturing something like, in the garden in the beginning of Genesis, Adam is already taking, he's already naming the animals. This is already like contributing in a certain way. And, you know, one way to think of this is God did one thing and Adam did another thing. But a second way to think of this is, this is God delegating some of his tasks through creation, through us. And as I read Scripture, I see almost a development or evolution in precisely that direction. I think of, for instance, how the second creation after the flood, that second creation is entirely dependent on the action that Noah, a human, took. The creation that we inhabit today is the result of a human being having taken a really substantial role in that co-creative activity. And so I agree with you. It's not like just out of the substance of our thought to try to drastically reform creation. But I do think there's a role to play that we have, and it has a lot to do, like you said, with fostering the right feelings in ourselves. And then also the other side of that is, well, from the right feelings should flow the right deeds. And that has quite a lot, I think, to do with the kind of stewardship or care for the creation that is all around us and of which we're part. And that brings me to actually the second comment I wanted to make. I think it's a false dichotomy, actually, to think of there's reality and then here's our minds and you have to pick one. Because our minds are, again, almost axiomatically, they're not something, some other place. Where else would they be? And they're part of this whole. They're part of this oneness of all creation. And so I think there's no way around the fact that with our thoughts, we are changing reality. And there's an immediate, you know, with that recognition comes an immediate sense of responsibility to uphold our office in a way that is befitting of the powers and position that we've been given.
Yeah, that's very helpful. Yeah. You know, our minds aren't fixed, and if we sort of assume that our minds are somehow apart and that we can therefore turn them to move everything, you know, the bits around, as it were, we're falling back into the old scientistic mentality, but from a different perspective. Yeah. Landon, over to you.
I was just going to just follow up on Max's point that I also wanted to make, is that in order to think and talk about reality, we have to do some of that analysis we talked about earlier, make some distinctions, many of them quite helpful, between, say, mind and matter and, you know, me and the world around me, that kind of thing. But at the end of the day, there's a sort of unanalyzable whole that we're really trying to think and talk about, which makes it really difficult. But when we talk about, can we, through our thoughts, exercise this kind of substantial control over reality, it's really like, I mean, our thoughts themselves being as much a part of reality as whatever it is we're trying to control are part of the process by which reality is changing. And so
immediately, whatever thought you think at once sets your gray matter, as you mentioned, Landon. at once sets it into action. And so this is like demonstration of the principle that your thought is part of reality, and it has ripples of influence that ripple outwards into reality. Your thought sets your gray matter into motion. Your gray matter sets your nervous system into motion. Your nervous system sets your limbs into motion. And already this is like outward ripples of influence.
And I guess then the quality of thought matters. You know, think of something like power. You know, if you think of power mostly as a kind of personally possessed agency, then that, it feels to me, is going to lead to a kind of rarefication of reality. Whereas if power is much more about stepping towards being drawn by a power that is beyond you, the power of love, say, a kind of allure, then that's going to change you as you're drawn towards that, maybe with a lessening of the sense of the self would be one obvious example. It's not just that our thoughts ripple out, but that our thoughts ripple in. And if that kind of bilateral process is, I guess, what a spiritual tradition would foster.
I think that's well said. Our power to think doesn't come from us. It comes from somewhere higher. So all of our power is derivative from God. It doesn't originate with us in any way.
Okay, you want to say more?
I was just going to say, one of the things that Barfield famously taught Lewis in their Great War, the first one is that he undid chronological snobbery. The second one is that our thought, if it's anything meaningful at all, is participation in the divine logos. And so it's nothing, there's nothing originating from us. We're not fountains of rationality. We're participants in the rationality that's inherent in the created world.
Yeah, no, that's really well put. Now, look, I want to get onto something about final participation at some point and this big Barfieldian idea. But Max, you mentioned maybe saying something about the place of Rudolf Steiner in Barfield, but particularly as it shows up in this new collection, The Riddle of the Sphinx.
Yeah, I did want to propose something. I think it's quite, Barfield seems to acknowledge this, it's quite a provocative statement on his part. But I think everyone who's familiar with Barfield, even if they're not familiar with Steiner on his own terms, is probably familiar with Barfield's relationship to Steiner and the influence that Steiner had. Incidentally, today is the birthday of Rudolf Steiner, the 163rd anniversary, so it's maybe a felicitous occasion to talk over this. The passage I had in mind particularly comes from an essay somewhere in the middle of the collection. It's called The One and the Many, and he concludes the... I understand this is given as an address somewhere, but he concludes it by basically comparing the place of Rudolf Steiner to the place of Aristotle. He says, "I'm not a prophet, but for what it may be worth, the dim vision I have, when I peer into the future, strongly suggests that the redemption of civilization will depend in a very great degree on whether its intellectual structure comes to center around the contribution of Rudolf Steiner to much the same extent as that of the Aristotelian age centered around Aristotle. To the same extent, not of course in the same way." To my mind, what he's suggesting, I'm somewhat sympathetic to this idea, partly because I don't think there's any indication, there's any evidence that is indication to reject it at this point. And what I mean by that is it took hundreds of years after the time of Aristotle before his thought ascended and took on the dominant role that it did through all the scholastic period in the Middle Ages. We are next year, I believe, 2025, arriving at the centennial of Steiner's death. This is like a flash in the pan, the blink of an eye, in terms of these time frame that we're talking about if we're in respect of the evolution of consciousness. Barfield, I think, is suggesting that Steiner, not even necessarily that he gives us the correct scientific answers or the correct propositional content even. I think Barfield is suggesting that, like Aristotle, Steiner is trying to supply us with the forms and the forms and the dynamics by which the new mode of thinking can be elaborated in the age to come. I think Barfield has in mind that Steiner, Barfield does see Steiner as a sort of prophet of final participation. So I think many things around the mystery of final participation in Barfield's mind, he sees as contained in many of Steiner's works.
So this is why I find Barfield very challenging, partly because I think this idea that Aristotle was sort of forgotten and not received for centuries and centuries isn't actually, if I may say so, isn't quite true, because so-called Neoplatonism was engaging with Aristotle's ideas, and the way that Plato was received, certainly by the time you get to Christianity, but in the centuries before as well, was without this sense that there's Plato or Aristotle, but that they were always already in a deep kind of dialogue. And so the reason why that's significant, though, is not to argue the history, that's a waste of time, but it's more to say that I think that Aristotle's ideas, they were received from, their inception and fed the wider intellectual discourse that went on in the ancient world. And the way that I, rather than just sort of using that to somehow put Steiner down, which I don't want to do either, is to ask myself, how do Steiner's ideas, formed in the particular way that Steiner does form them, how are they actually already present? And I think that you can find signs that they are present. I mean, in some ways, our earlier conversation about analysis and analogy might be part of that. But when you think about, say, the notion of the imagination, and Barfield does talk about this in, I think it's in The One and the Many as well, actually, the same essay, or maybe also another essay in this collection, The Nature of Meaning, where he talks about how the imagination, recognizing it as a cognitive function, not just a sort of production of fantasy, that's something which has been done in recent times, particularly by figures like Coleridge. But then taking the imagination not just as pointing to a kind of horizon beyond which we can't perceive, but that we're able to say more about that source from which our ideas are given to us through the imagination. And I think figures like Dante did this. I think particularly in the Paradiso, you get a lot of what Steiner or Barfield would call supersensible perception, in the way that Dante describes the Paradiso. I'm working on William Blake too, and I think that when Blake talks about the imagination as a kind of contact with the real things, so for example, when he says, when I look at the sun, I don't just see a round disc about the size of a guinea rising in the sky, I see the heavenly host crying, holy, holy, holy. And he'll talk about how perception is not like looking at the window, but looking through the window. So his idea there is that if you look through a window, you don't look at the glass and think how lovely the glass is. You look through the window at what the glass transmits. And so that our senses become portals. How do I know but that every bird that cuts the airy way is an immense world of delight enclosed by the senses five? So I think you have a range of people actually who have invited us to think of the imagination in ways that, so far as I know, and I wouldn't claim to be a Steiner expert, but that are quite resonant with Steiner's insights. And so rather than almost sort of setting up civilization for a fall, unless it grasps Steiner, which sometimes I feel Barfield intimates, it might be more fruitful to think about how reading Steiner can help us surface more clearly facets of understanding which actually are current in not the mainstream and certainly not the scientific world, which we were talking about earlier, but are current, say, in romantic traditions, and to become more confident in that way. But I wonder what you make of that.
Well, I think Coleridge is a good person to point to, but it's not for the reason that he just celebrates the imagination. I don't think there's any, like you alluded to, I don't think there's anything novel about that at all. I don't think that's necessarily what Barfield has in mind with Steiner. Just to set up an analogy, I agree with you that Aristotle wasn't ignored, certainly. But I think in order to understand the age that we are maybe, that is maybe like coming to the twilight, the age of science and reason, you have to see the way in which Aristotle's thought laid the foundations for that to be possible, in a way that that this more hermetic and symbolic and mythological approach of many of the contemporary thinkers around the time of Aristotle, Plato, and then even later, like we said, the Neoplatonists, they lacked that kind of analytical rigor that Aristotle provided. And it wasn't, you know, I think it still was necessary. And, you know, the scientific revolution didn't emerge until thousands of years after Aristotle's time. And so to me, it's like, this is the way to think about what Barfield would be suggesting in respect to Steiner. Now, with Steiner, the imagination is an important piece, but I don't think it's the real crux of what Steiner is proposing. I think to get to the real crux, it actually has less to do with, maybe this is an exaggeration, I almost said has less to do with the poets and more to do with the phenomenologists. And Steiner, for a reason that seems to me to be just almost like an accident of history, Steiner is not seen as one of the co-fathers of phenomenology together with Edmund Husserl, but they both studied under Franz Brentano. And to me, Steiner, his real beginning and the real foundation of Steiner's thought is this, it's difficult to describe, but let me try to present an analogy. When we are, as infants, we have to go through this process and exercise and development of coordinating our physical limbs, understanding that, through this intention, then my limb responds in this so on way. And you see, we're not born with that. It's something we have to develop in kind of painstaking elaboration. Steiner is actually trying to lay down a path by which we perform some analogous function in respect to the movements, the dynamics of the psyche itself, the mind itself, consciousness itself. It's like he gives an analogy in one place. He says, imagine somebody walking down the street with his limbs flailing in every direction, like knocking over cars. He says, that's how people are today in respect to their thoughts. And so I really feel if you peel back all of Steiner's anthroposophical teachings down to their very pith and narrow, you find this phenomenological, so this kind of introspective phenomenological approach, and then the corresponding pathway of trying to develop a kind of agency and rigor of that spiritual capacity in us that up until now we have been more or less just taking for granted. We already touched on this in respect to the scientific approach. It's like you're dealing with the products of thought, but not the power and agency and activity of thinking that creates those products to begin with and manipulates them and elaborates them.
So, Max, that's the part of what I understand of Steiner that I find really compelling, what you just described. But I wonder if it's worth talking briefly about the things that keep people away from that, which are that there are a lot of elements of Steiner's writing that are difficult to understand and just, I mean, strange is a weak word. I can't think of a better one, though. But, like, even in this last essay, or second-to-last essay in the collection, I found it to be one of the most troubling and interesting essays of this book, and it's called The Light of the World, where much of it's spent, Barfield spends giving an anthroposophical interpretation of the Gospel of John. And in it, there's these incredible passages that are sandwiched between paragraphs and paragraphs of stuff about like hierarchies and astral bodies and etheric bodies and Atlantis and all this. And I just have no idea what to make of it, right? I don't know. But then he follows up immediately saying things like this. And now we may well feel that something has happened after interpreting some of these passages from St. John. Like a cracking of the hard rind of a seed by the new life stirring within it. As if a stone had been rolled away, not only from the tomb of our sense-bound thinking, but from the whole historical development of Christianity. And we shall feel a sort of astonishment when we reflect on the somber and gloomy thing which has been made of Christianity, perhaps by the Protestant confession as a whole, but certainly by all manner of narrow evangelical sects which have sprung up in the West in the last two or three centuries. We shall feel this astonishment when we read, for instance, in St. John's Gospel, certain utterances of the Son of Man, such as, I am come that ye might have life, and that ye might have it in more abundantly. Or these words have I spoken unto you, that my joy might remain in you, and that your joy might be full. Above all, we may feel that we now understand a new and triumphant way those solemn words of Christ, I am the light of the world. So that's a deeply stirring passage to me. But in context, I don't understand, you know, what connection that has to all the things that Steiner is talking about before that. And so I'm not asking you to answer that question, but I am wanting just to make the point that I don't know what to make of the claims that Barfield makes about Steiner, because, you know, he seems to draw these lessons from them that are deeply compelling to me. Yet when he's actually describing how Steiner gets there and these concepts that he uses, I find myself bewildered and sometimes a little bit disturbed. And so that's just an honest, I know that draws the ire of some Barfield enthusiasts when you say that, you know, when you're not just fully devoted to Steiner, but it's just an honest reflection is I don't know what to make of that. And I'm certainly not alone in that. There's a lot of people who feel that Barfield is very compelling and then immediately feel that they've, you know, lost sight of that once he gets into the mode of interpreting Steiner directly.
Noah, I'm not one of those Barfield enthusiasts that you alluded to that would be offended by an honest appraisal on your part from Steiner. A couple things come to mind. I don't know if you ever tried to do this, but it can feel like a extremely futile attempt to try to convey some of the treasure and wealth of the Gospels of Christianity as a whole to somebody who has never worked with it. It's like you might as well be speaking Greek to somebody who doesn't speak. It's completely incomprehensible to them. I can fairly confidently say that if you were able to travel back to the time of Aristotle or even 100 years ago and started to convey to them some of the way that modern physics, for instance, interprets the essence of physical reality, just any of our contemporary scientific concepts, these would be completely inscrutable to somebody not very long ago. It would sound like it would sound probably not so different actually than some of Steiner's description sound. And I know obviously that doesn't prove them or establish them as verify them, but I think it can leave us with a sense of how necessary it is to suspend judgment about these things. Barfield obviously lived a long life, and he encountered Steiner in his early 20s, I believe, and so he was working with Steiner's ideas and terminology for decades and decades. My own experience can corroborate that. There's something that the more you work with them, the more they begin to reveal their value. But I'd also say that Steiner himself didn't. And regrettably, this point that he made is often lost on many anthroposophists. He never said, well, he repeatedly urged people not to believe anything, any of the statements that he made, but rather to think them. So this is not a question of assenting to them. This is rather a question of entertaining them, sustaining the thought in your mind, and then, again, making empirical, phenomenological observations about what this does. And so that, to me, is very clear how Steiner's teachings can be corrupted and turned into something that, at least in my interpretation, is almost the reverse of what he actually would have wished. But to be fair, like almost any teaching can be the same can be done to almost any teaching. So I guess that would be my response. The last thing I would just say is Barfield himself somewhere, I don't recall the exact chapter and verse, but he makes this comment like, there are some things that Steiner says that I can verify in my own experience and therefore believe them. There are other things that he says that I can't verify in my experience, but they seem plausible, so I generally like entertain a degree of plausibility and probability that they're true. And then there's a third category that I just don't know what to do with, and those I just suspend judgment about. Mm-hmm. That's kind of where I stand about these things.
Yeah.
But there was another comment that Barfield makes in his collection, one of the essays that helped me as well, where he says that much like in his 20s when he realized that reading poetry has this felt shift of consciousness effect upon him, and that he recognized that to read poetry, therefore, is not just to work out what it's saying, but is to receive the energy that the words themselves produce, and that if you can keep that alive, the poem takes you somewhere that is much further than just trying to work out what the poem's saying. So he says that when he began to read Steiner, the words of Steiner had a similar effect upon him. They kind of stirred something within him, and that as long as he maintained that felt consciousness of the energy of what was being stirred and didn't rush to try to understand, he felt that Steiner kept on giving him something. And I think that was a very helpful comment to me, partly because I can relate to that, not so much in terms of Steiner, but I read a lot of William Blake. And William Blake, too, you can sometimes break down into the, yeah, I get that. No, I don't quite get that, but it seems plausible. And then, you know, I'm not quite sure what on earth he's going on about. But there's something about the experience, which is the words and the imagery, the context of an epic as a whole and so on, that you want to stay open to because you feel like it's going to communicate more to you rather than just shutting it down too quickly. And so I found that a helpful comment of Barfield's, which I'd not quite read before, actually. I'd read about how poetry kind of saved him in his 20s, but not how that he'd had the same experience with Steiner.
I think that's very helpful, Mark, Ed, because these are different, again, like different modes of cognition. In one case, you're like mining the content for some something, like some propositions that you can extract. In the other case, you are engaging with the content, but with how do I say this? But like with an attentiveness to what it evokes in you, what it calls forth in you, in your own psyche. And to me, those are just fundamentally different modes of engagement. And I really feel you hit the nail on the head when you suggested that that's what Steiner is actually asking for. And I really, in my experience, that's actually been a much more fruitful way to read almost any literature and also any scripture too. I think it's often feel that it's a dead end. It's a kind of futile, vain pursuit to kind of haggle over like what is the correct like historical significance of one or another passage. It cheapens it in a way. You're missing something that's much more sublime.
Yeah, and again, for me, there were kind of parallels. So, for example, there was a book which came out a couple of years ago now, but I thought was very tremendous, Merlin Sheldrake's book, Entangled Life, which at one level is just a very well-written book about fungi and all that's been discovered about mycelial networks and so on. But it's more than that, because the way that Merlin writes evokes a certain attitude to the world which you didn't quite have before. And I think that part of the reason why this book has really entranced people is because it's kind of re-enchanting things in the same time as describing things. And that's the quality of writing that can bring about a final participation. And again, just a last comment from me, and so maybe we'll begin to wrap things up, but a last comment for me on this notion of final participation. At one point in one essay, I think it's The Nature of Meaning, Barfield talks about how we need new myths in order to engage with nature, but nature needs new myths as well in order to become more itself. And I, if you think of myths not as attempts to explain, but myths as framings, metaphors, stories, encounters that enable us to participate more fully with ourselves, with the world around us. I felt that Merlin Sheldrake's book, Entangled Life, in a way is doing that. And so that sense of being attentive to the quality of what we're writing, the energy it brings, the consciousness, therefore, that it stirs, rather than this much more analytical, that's going to be the word of the conversation, I think, approach that just tries to sort of pin things down. I find that very encouraging and feel that, you know, with luck, we'll be entering a new phase where even science writing is trying to do that. And so not just evoke wonder in a kind of gawping sense, as if we're somehow separate from this cosmos that's around us, that whilst it amazes us, it just leaves us feeling empty and meaningless at the same time. Quite the opposite, that because we can know that our experience of wonder is an invitation that must be, at least in some small part, a receipt of that which is actually there, the intelligence within which our intelligence is embedded, you know, the thoughts with which our thoughts are but echoes and reflections. Embracing that feels to me to be a very exciting as well as, you know, hopeful way forward. And, you know, Barfield's comments on Steiner helped me to, you know, clarify that for me a little bit further.
But I think a key to what you said, Mark, and you already touched on this earlier, it's that this is not what you described just there in final participation. It's by no means a question of discarding the analytical approach. It's rather harvesting all of the capacities for rigor and analysis that this sort of scientific mode of thought has, that we've refined in ourselves through the scientific mode. It's harvesting those, gathering them together, and then marshaling them towards the higher meanings that are present to us, but that now we are capable of approaching in a much more rigorous and maybe accurate way.
Thanks for that. That's absolutely right. Look, we've been talking for a little while now. It's lovely to talk again, and people must remember that we've talked twice before, and so you can look up those conversations as well. But is there anything that Max or Landon you'd like to raise in the last few minutes now that it feels really pressing from this new collection?
Yeah. Actually, maybe can we end with a passage from Meaning, Revelation, and Tradition in Language and Religion?
That's a great idea
for a little essay. But this one, for readers of Barfield, I think maybe others will have this experience. It was immensely clarifying to me as a way of thinking about Barfield's work as a whole. So he starts out by saying, long before he understood anything about what it meant, he said he was enchanted by these words. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And he said he didn't have a clue what they meant, but something about them just enchanted him. And then he goes on a little later. Of course, I was already beginning to feel the fascination of words in the ordinary sense, bits of human language, and no doubt that had much to do with it. But what connection could there possibly be between the words and their history and the Word, capital W, in that fateful sentence? It is only since I started trying to arrange my thoughts on the subject of this lecture that I suddenly realized that practically all I've ever written on the subject of language and other matters connected with it could be characterized not inaccurately as attempts to answer that very question. You know, the words that we speak and the eternal divine Word that was in the beginning, in and through which all things were created, that connection is, for me, a really helpful way of seeing what is Barfield up to. He's trying to explain that.
Thanks for that, Landon.
Yeah, no, that's very beautifully put. And you said at the beginning, Landon, I think that, you know, Barfield, he returns to these big themes and these talks and then essays and books are constant returns to these big themes. And what's wonderful is that you get repeated glimpses, felt experiences, as you're describing there, of what he's communicating, what he's seeing himself, And, you know, as someone who is Christian, I find it very helpful when he reflects on things like verses from John's Gospel. And again, you can share the sense of allure that these phrases have, and then he helps unpack. And so through analysis, you know, deepen your appreciation of that allure. Yeah. Okay, well, look, just to say that there's more than we've touched on today in these essays as well. There's quite a lot about the relationship between Western traditions and Eastern traditions, reflections on reincarnation, reflections on how the West can bring something to the Eastern tradition as much as the East can to the West as well. And I think that's they're important themes as well. So, guys, maybe we should return to you know, a second round and thinking about something like that too at some point. So look, for now, let's draw to a close and remind people of our own books, Secret History of Christianity in my case, and What Barfield Thought in your case, but particularly this new book from Barfield Press, and The Riddler of the Sphinx, edited by Rory O'Connor as well. But thanks very much for now.